Welcome to the Power User Podcast, brought to you by NeoWin.net and WinCustomize.com. In this segment, we're talking about some hot topics in tech news. Joining me today are Derek Batting, NeoWin Site Supervisor, and Brad Wardell of Stardock Corporation. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing? How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. So the first topic that's up today, Google Maps and love. Derek, what's going on with Google Maps and
love, sweet love. Well, the fine folks at Frozen Bear decided to incorporate Google Maps into the Hot or Not sites and have come up with Hot Maps, which is tied to the Hot or Not database. And it allows people on Hot or Not to not only see and vote for each other, but to see where each other is located geographically. And if they're close to each other, they can opt to send each other messages and potentially meet up.
And some of the concern on this topic, I think, was that this could be used as a stalking tool. But in fact, right, that's not the case, right? Well,
no, that's not the case at all.
Not a very good stalking tool, at least.
Yeah, it's a pretty lame attempt to, if you tried to use it as a stalking tool. One of the guys that had his hand in programming this, Jeff Marshall, was quoted as saying, "I wouldn't want to pinpoint people by their exact addresses even if I could." He said, "I've read a few comments online about how this is the ultimate stalker tool. I think those comments are partly tongue-in-cheek, but even so, it isn't really a very good stalker tool since it's only groups people by zip code."
Yeah, I mean, Yahoo Personals, pretty much every personal service has the ability to look where someone is in a, you know, in the general vicinity. So yeah, that's nothing new. I think it's kind of a neat toy, and it makes people more likely to go on to Hot or Not. If you didn't, you know, probably you had to put up a picture of yourself in order to join a site, and I don't think the world's ready for pictures of me on their site.
Would it be a Hot or a Not, do you think, Fred?
Well, they only have a positive scale, so, you know, it's a 1 through 10, and since they don't support negative numbers, I'm worried. I wouldn't want to be responsible for crashing their site as people try to find a way to put negative number entries into there.
I see. Well, that would be a shame, of course. Have you been on the Hot or Not site, Brad?
I just discovered it today and been going through and exacting my revenge on all these these nameless people. Oh yeah, you know, based on how good looking they are. Oh yeah, you wouldn't have gone out with me in high school. One for you.
There you go. Sounds like it's been very cathartic for you, Brad.
I'm purging the inner demons.
There you go. All right, so you know, people go on to these things, and you if you're going to try and do an online dating service, you kind of have to know who's in your area. So Certainly grouping people by zip code, it doesn't seem like it's a big deal. And of course, if you don't want to do it, then don't do an online dating service, for goodness sakes, you know.
Yeah, it's really not a whole lot different than putting in whatever town you happen to live in or surrounding suburbs and looking for matches that way. This just incorporates an actual interactive mapping system with it rather than just choosing a city from a drop-down box.
You know, and going right along with that, of course, is for those people who, are looking for love but don't want to actually meet people, Amazon has apparently opened a sex store.
It's about damn time.
I couldn't believe it.
Where was I supposed to buy my sex stuff before Amazon.com? Because no one, I mean, is there anything sexual-oriented on the internet? I mean, I certainly can't find it.
And on top of that, you can never find those stores in real life. So certainly,
yeah, they simply don't exist. I mean,
high and low for
thank God someone has finally stepped up to the plate to fill the hole.
I gotta say, I'm frankly surprised that Amazon did this. From the sounds of it, it's not something that, you know, they put out a big press release that's not on their
bitter
front page.
Don't let your bitterness get the best of you.
Did you
just say Amazon stepped up to fill the hole?
Ooh.
Well,
anyway,
yeah.
Back to the story.
Right. So I think, you know, a lot of people are kind of surprised by this. I'm surprised by it. Some people are outraged, but I don't know if there's really a reason for outrage because Amazon sold pornographic books previously.
Damn straight they did.
And
I mean, not that I know personally.
Right. No, of course not you. So the truth is, you know, I don't know what to say about it, as usual. It's like, sex is everywhere. I suppose Amazon felt like they needed to get into that game for some reason or another.
Amazon
that
encourages the objectifying of women has to be applauded and encouraged.
Hmm. Well, I'll just be running over you after the show.
I don't know where that came from.
Right, exactly. Nice try.
I just had to slip that part in.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go again.
Hey, that would segue nicely into our next segment.
Which is?
Psycho bosses.
Psycho bosses. Well, let's go with that topic. Psycho bosses, Brad. He doesn't know anything about being a psycho boss. And I,
of course,
don't have psycho bosses at all. Not me. Not me.
No, your boss is a saint.
Absolutely.
That's what the voices tell me,
and
anyway.
And I do whatever he tells me to do. I love my job.
Yes, I will see it again and again.
Yeah, exactly.
It was better than
I
cats.
I laughed. I cried. It became a part of me.
So, Derek, have you seen this quiz online? This is your boss a psycho quiz?
Well, considering I'm self-employed, I would have to say yes.
Your boss is a psycho, right?
Oh, indeed.
He must have been to hire you. Right. So what is this? I'm looking at this quiz right now. It actually quiz, is your boss a psychopath? But it's not like a joke quiz. It's the real thing.
It's a serious one.
And, it was created by Robert Hare to evaluate 20 personality traits of your boss. And this was for Fast Company magazine. It's a legitimate quiz.
What kind of questions do they ask here? What do we have?
Some of the ones we have here. Yeah, is he glib or superficially charming? Mm-hmm. Does
hey,
he have a grandiose sense of self-worth? Is he a pathological liar?
Listen to me.
I'm talking. Look over here. Yeah, does he have a blog? Does he do a podcast? Does he keep interrupting people as he tries to speak?
Right. Yes. The scale only goes to 40, but you scored an 87, Brad. I'm telling you.
No!
Yeah, pathological liar, con artist, or master manipulator.
I'm just saying you'd look better if you showed off your attributes.
Right. You know, I don't know if I've had a boss that actually fits into the psychopath category, but I've had some bad bosses. They actually have a link on this website. This is fastcompany.com. They have a link here to...
Who's, by the way, never done a story on Stardock. Bastards.
And why not, I asked them. Why? Look at me.
We've been in business for 75 years, and we've averaged a growth rate of over 1.2%. How can they not call us a fast company? But yeah, they have bosses from hell on there.
Yeah, they do. They have links to what they call a rogues gallery of the manipulative, abusive, and grandiose, which is great.
And downright crooked. Along with that link, they also have Coping with Psychos at Work by
right.
Martha Stout, author of The Sociopath Next Door.
Excellent. So if you're...
Might be worth reading in general.
Exactly. If you've got some problems
at work...
Yeah,
it's actually part of our employee guide here.
Right. If you've got problems at work, you can go... on the one hand, you can go vent, tell your story or listen to other people's stories about bosses from hell. And then on the other hand, you can actually get some good advice on how to cope. So
we have that IP blocked here.
That's right. We don't want people coping, for goodness sakes.
That's right. Yeah, Kristen, the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Right.
Kristen, did you catch the last sentence
what
in
was
that,
that
quiz? We've used the pronoun he, but research suggests psychologists have underestimated the psychopathic propensity of women.
Oh, God.
I'm glad that somebody is finally recognizing my potential.
Not only that.
At last.
I think half the guys I know have a psychopath ex-girlfriend story
That's
they can
true.
Tell.
That's
and
true.
And some of those women have to be in positions of authority by now.
You would think, right?
The ones that aren't locked up in mental institutions anyway.
Right. Yes, psychopaths comes in all shapes and sizes and genders, so it's certainly not something that's exclusive to men.
They don't just give you those cute little jackets to tie in the back. You have to earn them, you know.
That's right. And I've done my best, but I still haven't gotten one. How
what
in the world are we going to segue into our next topic?
Which is?
It's just not funny at all. Apparently, Microsoft and Google are in a lawsuit over a non-compete. They have an employee who was at Microsoft and is now at Google.
Speaking of manipulative, abusive, and grandiose, Microsoft!
Yeah, I wonder how many people posted about people from Microsoft. We, of course, have only good things to say about both Microsoft and Google.
Because, we love them. They
because
are
they
part
have
of us.
Half of Brad's soul is
it's kept
in
a jar in Redmond, Washington. So I naturally want to. But on the other hand, Google controls the Google world, and we have Google ads on our site. And so they help pay for Win Customize and NeilWin.net, and we like that. So what? It's like, Mom and Dad, don't fight. You're making us cry.
You're tearing us apart.
Yeah, but yeah, Kai Fu Lee was a vice president, executive at Microsoft. And apparently he worked on MSN Search in some capacity, though that's even sketchy. And he has been hired by Google, and Microsoft launched a lawsuit saying that violates his non-compete with them.
That's amazing. You know, he apparently went on sabbatical, and then he contacted Microsoft to tell them he wasn't coming back from sabbatical and that he was going to go work for Google. And that when he gave them the official notice, they had that lawsuit in motion that day.
That day. You know, and that's amazing because, I mean, Microsoft's developers can need 5 years to make a new operating system, but their lawyers can do it in a day. They need to get the lawyers in on the software development side.
Yeah, I don't know. Given a little further thought to that, I don't know if that'd be such a good idea. Let's keep them out of it. So apparently this guy's of course claiming that there is no violation of the non-compete. He's saying that he's working on completely different things at Google.
He never saw so much as a piece of code from anything relating to Microsoft Search or MSN or anything like that.
But that's not even the point, though. I mean, because he's a vice president, he's privy to all of Microsoft's strategy documents and confidential stuff. I think, and this is a case, God help me, and another couple years in hell after I die, but the evil empire, Microsoft, is right. If he worked on MSN Search in any capacity at all,
then he had any information about it.
Right. I mean, if he worked on MSN Search, whether he was looking at source code or not, this non-compete should be in effect. Because if a non-compete can't keep a guy from going from one search engine job to another search engine job, then why even have non-competes?
Well, you might be right in this situation, Brad, and only in this situation.
Oh.
No, but you might be right in this situation, but of course what it's going to come down to legally is what was actually in that non-compete agreement, and what is he actually doing now?
Well, I think Lee denied that the MSN desktop search was recently developed by his group. He's claiming that he really wasn't involved on it, and so it's gonna be pretty messy. But I think what ticks off Microsoft is that here you have a guy who was an executive, a high-level vice president guy at Microsoft, and now he's gone over to Microsoft's probably most fierce competitor. I mean, because Google's unlike any company Microsoft has ever had to compete with, in that Google's actually competent. I mean, they are an incredibly well-oiled machine. And I say that not just because I have sent my resume over there.
Right.
But they really are, incredibly on the ball. Everyone Microsoft's had to compete with in the past has been just incredibly incompetent, whether that be IBM and OS2 or WordPerfect and Lotus and all the whole nine yards of them were just inept beyond belief. But this time, Google's pretty sharp, and now they're plucking off Microsoft's talent as here in wine, and I think Microsoft's getting fed up.
Well, once again, we're just going to have to wait and see what comes out in the end because, courts are not always, they don't always, even though you might have all the right evidence and all the right things to say, they don't always find in your favor. So,
and not only that, non-competes are still in their infancy on how enforceable they really are.
Yeah, you can bet they're going to pick that apart letter by letter in court. It's going to come down to a Clinton-type scenario where you're going, well, can you define is?
Yeah.
Can you define?
I will say something, though, another thing in favor of the lords and masters of my soul over at Microsoft. They don't do that to other – they may have once done it to other companies. But I know Microsoft's picked off a couple of our guys, and they would not have hired them if we hadn't waived our non-compete. We actually have non-competes here at Stardock, and one of our last guys, he wanted to go there. It was his dream job, but Microsoft wouldn't have hired him if we didn't formally waive the non-compete. They just – they honored it, so to speak. We waived it because, we treat – we like to think of people who work here as our friends, and if you want to work on that stuff, we wanted to let them. But Yeah, Microsoft, when it shoots the other way, at least now, and I'm sure someone listening to this wants to go, are you kidding? Microsoft used to zap, take people from Apple left and right. Well, fine, yo. But today, they seem to be a little bit more sensitive about other people's non-competes.
And, of course, them getting burned a few times is probably plays into that a little bit. All right, well, that's, you know, once again, that's a wait and see, but it's good information to have, and it's something that's important for people to keep in mind when they're signing those non-competes. It really is a serious thing, and they need to take it seriously. So how about this Linus trademarks Linux? What is going on there? Didn't he have a trademark on that already?
Well, Linux has had a tortured trademark existence, and I don't know, I won't pretend to know the history too well, but I believe it started out even many years ago where someone else tried to trademark it, and eventually got the trademark was turned over to Linus. And last week, a law firm in Australia started sending out letters to companies using the Linux in their product name, demanding $5,000 to use it, as if trademark licenses are like patents. Oh, you're using our invention. Well, you have to use you have to license it from us. Well, you know, that obviously turned into a big a big blow up, because suddenly it looks like Linus is going and trying to cash in on the name. And one might argue he has some right to that, but that aside, that was not apparently what they were looking for. That what Linus wants to see happen, and I'm paraphrasing from what reports, is companies that are making a profit from using Linux in their name band together and pay towards a common legal defense fund so that they can enforce their trademark rights. So we don't end up with Linux Cola or Linux Condoms, the ultimate in open source. You know, I mean,
which could be found on Amazon.
Yes,
on Amazon.com,
so I can use them when I'm going on Hot or Not.
Right, exactly.
Anyway, it all ties together. Yeah, exactly. It's a circle of life. Type
See, thing. only a psycho boss would think of that.
Yeah. So true.
And so there is a legitimate concern. You do not want companies to be able to ride roughshod over the term Linux. I know that if I were the emperor of Microsoft, and let's face it, there's at this point, the leader of Microsoft should be called emperor, not CEO. I would be thinking, you know, if they're not protecting the Linux name, we could put out Microsoft Linux. It's not really Linux, but just uses the name.
And
muddy the water, mm-hmm. or only somewhat competitive, and muddy the waters. And I don't think, and just to be clear, I don't think Microsoft is planning to do this, but I'm just saying, if I were the Dark Lord over there.
You would do that, Brad? That's what you're saying?
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying. Yeah, you remember my 87 score on the psycho boss?
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, as a psycho, I have certain responsibilities
that
to my
true.
Fellow psychos.
You've got to live up to that name.
Yeah, it's tough.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Well, then the leprechaun that tells me what to do on that lives on my shoulder would be outraged. But anyway, they have to protect the mark. But
yes,
they have waited so long to start protecting it that it could be pretty tough. And right. It's going to certainly be pretty expensive, hence the creation of a new website called linuxmark.org. So they set up a website called linuxmark.org where people who have a vested interest in the mark can band together and put into a common legal defense fund. So it should not be thought of that they're going around. It is not true to think that Linus.
I think it's Linus.
Linus is running around trying to get $5,000 a pop so he can buy a new gold plated house and rocket car.
But
they just
want to
protect the name from scurrilous use.
Yeah, Linus came out and said specifically he wanted to make it clear that he doesn't see a dime of that money. None of it goes directly into his pocket. It all goes right back into Linux in general for the name and copyright protection, et cetera, et cetera. Also, this has nothing to do with open source software whatsoever. No one's going to have to suddenly start paying for software that was, always open source and always free. It has nothing to do with that. It's strictly a name and a trademark thing.
Absolutely. And, it's kind of amazing that people have so attached open source and Linux together that they can't separate them in their minds. And they think, oh, well, open source no longer free. And first of all, open source is not necessarily free. Open source is a type of license. You can still charge money for open source.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, open source is not just on Linux. There's plenty of open source for other operating systems. Even on even on Windows.
All right. Well, excellent information, you two. I really appreciate you joining me, of course, Derek and Brad.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. In this segment, we're talking about fans who love certain video games so much that they actually create conventions around the game. Returning to the show is well-known computer game reviewer Tom Chick and Brad Wardell of Stardock Corporation, regular contributor to Power User Podcast. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
How you doing?
Quite well.
You know.
It's always something.
Start?
Yeah, exactly.
I know. The tapeworms are really acting up this week.
Yeah. Well, Tom, you had a chance to visit QuakeCon recently, the convention for gamers who just loved Quake. What was that like?
QuakeCon is an enjoyable experience. QuakeCon, one of the prerequisites for really getting into QuakeCon is you have to be a huge id fan. You've got to really be into Doom, Quake, their Wolfenstein games. And you're surrounded by a bunch of people who are really into those games, some of which I liked more than others, none of which I think I would qualify as a hardcore fan for. But it's almost, it's got a sort of a tent revival vibe.
Is that right?
At times, yeah.
People pretty passionate about those games.
Very much so, very much so. The thing about QuakeCon is it's all unlike other conventions that might be organized by companies or have a very strong corporate sponsorship angle, like E3, for instance. QuakeCon still has retained a lot of its grassroots fan-based organization. It's 10 years old. This was its 10th anniversary.
Wow.
It's grown from, I think it started with 100 people at a little Best Western in somewhere in Texas. Now it's, I think they tend to add another 1,000 every year. The numbers aren't finalized yet. They were 6,000 last year, and their PR agency said they topped that this year, but they don't know exactly by how much yet.
Wow,
so basically 7,000 people. It's amazing, and they've gone from, they no longer fit into a single hotel anymore, so they hold it at this really kitschy resort in Texas called the Gaylord Texan Resort. And it's got this huge tacky atrium in the middle that's air conditioned and has this sort of Texan Mall of America vibe. And there's every hour, like on the hour, there are actors in there doing a gunfight shtick. Like one of them comes out and he's the marshal and the other guy's the criminal in the black hat. And they do this little comic patter with each other. And then one of them gets gunned down and it's all for the kids. So there's all these families running around, but it's come a long way since it started 10 years ago.
How much does it cost to get in?
QuakeCon is free. Unlike, for instance, Blizzard, they're starting BlizzCon at the end of October down here in Southern California. They're charging $120 per person, and it's two days. QuakeCon, it goes for 4 days, and it's absolutely free. You basically
how do they pay for your hotel room.
Then?
But, I mean, how does the shows, the people who put on the show, how do they pay for all that?
You know, that's a very good question, Brad. I would wager, I would guess that since there are a lot of, unlike the sort of corporate vibe of E3, this still has the fan vibe, but there are corporate sponsors there. So you've got an Activision booth, of course. You've got, because Quake fans tend to really be into the sort of bleeding edge hardware, you've got all these reps from Intel and NVIDIA and ATI and Asus and Logitech for their hardcore gaming mice. They've all set up booths, so I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, they pay for their booth space and that goes to renting the cost of the convention center. But I'm not sure, because there's no entrance fee. When you come in, it's sort of funny. When you come in to register, because it's all staffed by volunteers, when I came in to register, it was a 12-year-old kid who was taking my information.
and kick his ass?
You know what? I didn't want to start anything with him, because kids these days are pretty brutal at games. If I'd ended up in some kind of LAN tournament against this guy,
right,
I wouldn't have been pretty. So when you come in, it's free, but you have to sign a waiver, which basically says I won't sue QuakeCon if I break my leg. But it also has this little clause. I wish I'd kept it. I don't have it with me. There's a clause to the effect of I will behave and I will present myself in a responsible manner. And I think the subtext of that is I won't bug the families at the Gaylord Texan Resort who are here for something else. Because there are all these like gamers sprinkled in for the duration of QuakeCon with regular families, real
people. So bringing my paintball gun and playing Doom 3 for real with the, you know, pretending that the guests of the hotel are just, you know, various demons, not good, not Is that frowned on then?
I think they could then come up to you, present the waiver you signed, and say you're in violation. Go home.
Yeah.
See, that's just too harsh. I mean, if you can't shoot people with paintball guns in hotel and resorts, then I don't.
Well, the thing about QuakeCon is the reason you won't be running around shooting people. One of the amazing things of QuakeCon, which started as a LAN party, by the way, 10 years ago, is just some guys from an IRC channel. They thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we hung out in Texas and set up a LAN and played games for a few days? And they did. That's still a central part of QuakeCon. So they have the BYOC area, which is bring your own computer, where people bring their own computers. You have to reserve a spot here. A lot of people don't get spots. And a huge part, maybe two-thirds of this big convention center hall is filled with rows and rows of people who've brought their computers. And this year they had over 3,000 computers there. It's amazing to see that. And it's open 24 hours a day for the duration of the event. Wow. And there's no real structure to it. You just get in there, you start a game, you wait and hope that somewhere in this pool of 3,000 people their computers, someone else will join in. And it's this great sort of anarchy LAN party that will hopefully keep the people out of the corridors shooting Nerf guns at the regular visitors.
Well, I was looking on their site, and they also gave out cash prizes for various, you know, people who've won various events, whatever they may be, and they were substantial too. There's a picture on here, some guy holding a big novelty check for $25,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
That is huge.
And that's something too, Kristen, that I think you see in as gaming gets sort of moves more towards the mainstream and attracts more corporate sponsors. You can go to these conventions if you're really good at a game. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could, there are tournaments that offer cash prizes like that.
Right, and the chances are probably slim, but, you know, at least there's something you can do with those skills that you've honed over hours and hours of playing that game.
Yeah, and to be fair, not only are they slim, I think they're pretty much slim to none. You should see some of these guys in action. They did have a contest where this leading Quake player, if you could frag him once, you won, a cash prize, and if you actually beat him in the tournament, I don't know if it was a car, but it was something ridiculous like that.
Wow.
And I think they were pretty secure knowing that they weren't actually going to have to fork over a car because this guy was so good. Of the people I talked to couldn't even get a single kill on him. So it's amazing how good people are. And it's still surprising, though, that all this money gets funneled into these contests. Yeah.
And
these guys not only get prizes, by the way, they get, like in any sport, they get endorsements. You know, this guy Fatality endorsing, I don't know, NVIDIA or Logitech or stuff. He's got to get a hefty sum from that as well.
Jeez,
that's amazing.
Now you mentioned BlizzardCon. That Blizzard's starting up their own convention, so to speak. But it's a little bit more. It's Blizzard actually starting it. I'm surprised that its fan base didn't get together and do something like this already, especially with World of Warcraft. I mean, you can imagine a bunch of guilds getting together and getting a hotel and just going on a bunch of quests together or something in person.
And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of thing has happened on a smaller grassroots scale that we just don't know about. Also consider World of Warcraft isn't even a year old, so maybe people who had planned on doing this are going to be assimilated into BlizzCon. But I know EverQuest has something similar. I went to a Dark Ages of Camelot. I think they call theirs the Round Table. They have that every year. I went to a Dark Ages of Camelot gathering in Vegas last year. MMOs are sort of a natural for this sort of thing.
So this sort of thing is becoming, it's almost like the Star Trek phenomenon where it's just, people just go crazy for these games and they have these huge conventions and it becomes, the conventions themselves become a giant business.
There's something very communal about gaming, and not just multiplayer gaming, but about talking about gaming, and whether it's a message board or whether it's I have a LAN party every week, whether it's just sort of the you play something and then you like to talk about it. You mm-hmm. know, games are like, in a way, they're like movies. They're these sort of vivid experiences, and half of the fun is the sort of debriefing and talking about it afterwards with your friends. And I think gaming conventions are a larger social expression of this.
That's true. We're having a Halo 2 party here at StarDock next week, and then what's it called, Battlefield 2 party, you know, a couple weeks after that. And
the difference,
just
though,
to come over and
those are great, but the difference is you guys already work together. The thing,
oh, no,
the cool thing about
our,
the cons,
us and our friends too. But yeah, I mean, I understand total strangers getting together and doing
right.
it. Yeah, well, look at our quarter to three parties at you know, when we get together at E3, it's just great meeting all those guys and talking about the having that shared experience that you know, that you have on online.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, of course, wherever that happens, it's a sort of a great way to target a demographic. So you have the corporate sponsors and the advertisers jumping on board as well.
Right, and I'm sure they don't suffer from giving away a few, you know, items or a little bit of money for that. It probably comes back to them tenfold in terms of the advertising they get out of it.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. One of the features, too, of QuakeCon every year that I think they didn't have last year, John Carmack will come out and do a keynote address. And this had its inception, the very first QuakeCon with the 100 people at the little hotel in Texas, where Carmack and a few other people from id who'd gotten wind of this just sort of showed up unannounced. And Carmack sat with a few of the guys on a I think in front of the hotel and just sort of rapped with them for an hour about general stuff. He's very technically minded, and a lot of these guys here were as well. So Carmack will have a keynote address every year. He'd missed it last year because I think his son was born the year before. I think he teleconferenced in from somewhere. But what he does is he gets up on a stage and for literally hours, I think this year's was almost 2 hours, just stuff sort of unspools out of his mind. It's amazing seeing the way he works. He's got no notes. There's no teleprompter. He's just up there letting these ideas sort of flow out of him. And you get an idea of how his mind must work and how brilliant he is. A lot of it's way over my head, and it's sort of funny watching the audience. You've got all these hardcore Quake fans, some of whom are just players and wouldn't know the first thing about allocation buffers or whatnot. They're all in there. There's, I don't know, the halt this time must have had maybe 2,000 at least people in it. He comes out, there's the thunderous applause and even a few attempts at a standing ovation. I mean, they all love Carmack for what he's brought them. And then he starts talking. And after about 10 minutes, there's a little fidgeting. Maybe 20 minutes, a couple of brave souls think, you know, this is over my head. They start to get up and walk out. And, you know, Carmack is a genius, but not a very engaging public speaker. And a lot of the stuff he says, I can't make heads nor tails of, much less people who are just sort of fans of the game.
That's why I always go to IonStormCon. You know, cause I want to hear. I want to wait for, you know, John Romero, because, you know, after he may be his bitch, you know, I just wait on every word. But, you know, Carmack, you're right. He's not quite as engaging.
But he is a genius, and it is amazing seeing how much people sort of adore what he has done for them. You know, people sitting there, I think a lot of the people who do sit in that whole keynote speech do it sort of out of respect. It's almost like watching the credits after a movie. It doesn't make any sense to you, but just to show respect, you're going to sit through it.
Well, that's great. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation, Tom. I appreciate you joining us. And
thank you
as always, Brad.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. This week marks the 10th anniversary of Windows 95, and my, how the world has changed in the last 10 years.
Not really.
Returning to the show is Brad Wardell, as you just heard, of Startup Corporation, and Chris Quillis, Vice President of Software Development at Stardock. Hi, guys. How are you?
Good afternoon.
Oh, you know.
Oh, Brad.
Hi. It's just, I'm tired. I want to go home.
Well, you're
welcome
to go home.
Well, just look at it this way. You have 10 years worth of gray hairs that you didn't have when Windows 95 first came out.
Very true.
And they have more balding areas, too, which I'm quite certain was caused by Windows 95.
Is that right? Well,
I have to be.
Before we get into that, into why Brad has gone bald in the last 10 years, Chris, what can you give us some background on Windows 95? What led up to it in the first place?
Well, in the early days, there were vacuum tubes. And then there were computers where you shoved in little printed pieces of paper on punch cards that you'd laboriously labored over so that your time-shared computer could spit back out an answer for you sometime quicker than you using a slide rule to get to the answer in the first place. After that, as the personal computer market came about, and Microsoft and IBM managed to get together at a propitious time, I guess you could say, for Microsoft, we came up with DOS for many, many years. And lo, it was good, especially once you could have, you know, a partition greater than 32 megabytes on your newfangled direct access storage disks.
Yeah, they had 600, you could access 640K of memory.
Whoa, they're fancy pants, boy. Some of us only had 512K in our XTs. But
yeah, that's right. Commodore 64, you know.
As time went on, and Microsoft, you know, saw other things that were going on in the computer industry, most notably at Xerox PARC and with the Macintosh, they decided that they should have some of this fancy GUI action that was going on as well. And in conjunction with IBM, they set about, you know, building a platform for the future, both in terms of Windows as one layer to bring people into the GUI, and IBM's OS2 operating system, which was initially developed in conjunction with Microsoft, to provide a more stable, powerful business class platform for where everything would go in the future. And as time went on, Microsoft and IBM no longer quite saw eye to eye on where those OSs would go, most notably because Microsoft was having a great deal of success with their light little version of OS2 that was called Windows. And they split. And it was kind of a messy divorce, as divorces are prone to be. A lot of screaming, a lot of acrimony, the kids not knowing, you know, who to love anymore. But
Mom and Dad fighting all the time.
You're tearing us apart.
But as we got into the 90s and they went their separate ways, everybody had a chance to really try and do things right again. And, well, Microsoft failed at that with Windows 95. All the while, they were working on, you know, the good version of Windows, Windows NT. But they needed something to go on those computers with 4 megabytes of RAM and a reason to sell upgrades to Microsoft Word from your DOS version. Which brings us up to Windows 95, the fall of 95. I'd returned to college, the freshman girls were arriving, and the birds were singing in the trees. And somehow, for some reason, we were standing in long lines at midnight outside of a CompUSA, waiting for a box of software.
Don't tell me you were doing that. You were one of those people?
No, of course not. I was running OS 2 at the time. But
that's right.
It made for a better story.
I see. Yeah, you know, because I was hoping to pick up chicks there, but I don't think there are any chicks there. It takes a certain type of person to wait in line to buy the latest, you know, marketing, whatever, yes.
But, I mean, make no mistake. At the time, this, you know, we've seen things like, you know, you wait in line at midnight for the Harry Potter books now or for Lord of the Rings to show or the Star Wars movies. But in the mid-90s, that was one of the earlier cultural events that was manufactured that said you need to be here to do this even if you don't exactly know why.
And Windows 95 had a tortured development process because Microsoft had Windows 3.1. And Windows 3.1 had a completely different look and feel. It was a very primitive shell called Program Manager, and it multitasked barely with something called cooperative multitasking, which means that programs had to literally give up time to the CPU so that other programs could take their turn. DOS programs actually could be multitasked in their own virtual machines. This is Windows 3.1. But all Windows programs ran in the same memory space, which was meant that if one program caused a problem, it could bring them all down. And the only people who, you know, at the time, the only other people who thought that was tolerable were Macintosh users. Here comes the, you know, the required Mac bashing for this episode. But,
oh, dear.
Yeah, I mean, Mac actually had cooperative multitasking in one memory space up until OS X. Or there, you know, thereupon, I had lost track in System 9 or whatever. But Windows 95 changed that. It had some basic memory protection in there, and it could preemptively multitask Windows programs. And that was pretty amazing at the time. But not as amazing as the beta of Windows 95, which was called Chicago. Do you remember that, Chris? Chicago.
I remember 2 years of Chicago articles about how it was coming soon and it was going to change my life.
Yes, and it cured cancer, let you pick up chicks, the whole nine yards.
PC computing. When did PC computing have its preview, you know, of like it was coming real soon now? Like
COMDEX 93.
COMDEX 93.
Yep, I remember that. And it actually was a lot more powerful during the betas than what finally came out because they weren't worried. The compatibility slowly made it more and more wimped out. But during the beta, it was actually a little bit more robust. then it was a lot more robust than what finally came out, but it was a lot less compatible. And in the end, compatibility won out, and Microsoft basically took the view of, well, if you really need that much robustness, get Windows NT. Yeah, the thing is that what really was Windows 95? So it's 10 years ago this August, and it was essentially the shell ended up being what was, not to offend people, but, kind of a ripoff of OS2's workplace shell. It kind of looked similar to OS2's enhanced shell, but didn't have anywhere near the functionality, but it was good enough. The question had been taking over our mindshare for the past 3 years, whether we'd be running, what would be the successor of DOS, Windows, or OS2, was pretty much answered when, in August 1995, when people saw Windows 95, and even though it wasn't as good as OS2, it was good enough, and it was a hell of a lot more polished than OS2 was.
And it came preloaded on their Packard Bell.
That is
important, yeah.
And it had a cool rock. Didn't it have a rock song like Shut Me Down?
They licensed, Shut Me Down. They licensed Start Me Up from the Rolling Stones for, I believe at the time, the unprecedented price of $30 million, was it?
Well, that's right. And the rest is history. And now we're running Windows XP, which looks remarkably similar to Windows 95 in many ways. Still has a start bar, still has the recycle bin, still has My Computer.
I'm running Windows Vista. There's no more My Computer. Now it's just Computer. Digging through there, I did find the progman.exe file in the system directory, which I understand is there for compatibility with apps that might want to use its icons, though it doesn't actually run anything itself these days, we hope.
I suppose, was Windows 95 the first operating system that kind of set the tone for everything that's come after it? Was it significantly different than what had come before?
It was significantly different than any version of Windows that came before it, and today we are running the environment we enjoy today that, you know, has been borrowed by many, especially in Linux, has its roots traced back to Windows 95.
Well, excellent. Thank you both, Chris. That was very good information. And, you know, we really should tip our hats to Microsoft as much as we joke about them being, you know, the evil overlords. And I suppose to some extent they could actually be considered evil overlords.
Now
they're reformed evil overlords.
Oh, well, there
right.
we go.
Well, once they conquered OS2, they inherited the territory that OS2 used to occupy. And as serfs of that territory,
exactly.
We now are owned and controlled by Microsoft in every way. So all hail Bill Gates and,
everything and all the words coming out of your mouth right now.
I can be useful finding people to toil in their sugar mines.
Right, exactly. I can make myself useful. All right, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. This podcast was brought to you by neowin.net and wincustomize.com. Support us by subscribing to us on iTunes, Podnova, or odeo.com. Look for us every week at www.poweruser.tv.